The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
As I said earlier, I think part of the reason we're in this, a lot of the sort of sharp-edged choices we're in because people don't feel a sense of confidence that we can be nimble here, that we have institutions that can manage the complexity of these environments. And I think that it's really a lesson, frankly, for law enforcement and national security agencies around the world that if they want to be trusted with these tools that do have real risk associated with them, they're going to have to show that they can function with a real sense of transparency and accountability. I give the NSA a lot of credit for taking steps in that direction. I think you see similar kind of things happening in the UK. You see, hopefully, the rest of Europe will catch up as well. But I think that if law enforcement wants to be trusted, it can't always be in the mode of pushing the law to the maximum possible extent, because that doesn't make people feel good.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 16th, 2016. That was the voice of Daniel Weitzner explaining the fallout from the battle between Apple and the FBI on a panel at the IAPP Global Privacy Summit in Washington, D.C. Weitzner is the director of the MIT Internet Policy Research Initiative and principal research scientist at the MIT Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab. He was formerly the United States Deputy Chief Technology Officer for Internet Policy at the White House. He and Lawfare Editor-in-Chief Ben Wittes discuss the recent dispute between the Bureau and the technology giant, the boundaries of commercial use encryption, and the role of backdoors in law enforcement investigations. They conclude with thoughts on the policy implications of the latest reemergence of the crypto wars. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 166, Daniel Weitzner and Ben Wittes on Going Dark and the Fallout from Apple v. FBI.
Almost 20 years ago, as everyone knows, in the mid-90s, we had both a debate about cryptography policy, beginning with questions about whether regular old citizens should even be allowed to use strong cryptography, to which the then Clinton administration proposed, as many of you know, the Clipper chip, a kind of a way to split the difference, allow people to use strong encryption in order to protect their electronic communications, but require people or encourage people to escrow copies of their keys with trusted third parties. And then right around the same time, as many of you also know, the U.S. Congress, after very vigorous debate, enacted CALEA, the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, which prescribed a set of obligations on telephone companies to make sure that their new digital and mobile networks were tappable. It was a proposal ultimately that sought to preserve the status quo surveillance capabilities of that law enforcement had in the face of a number of technical changes. I think some people look at then and now and say, "Oh well, we're just in another one of those rounds of debate." And I think one of the reasons that I think the reaction to Comey speech in particular, the issue in general, I think one of the reasons the reaction has been so significant is that I think there's an intuitive sense that what law enforcement is asking for, however legitimate, is not just a status quo capability. I think what people instinctively understand what the Supreme Court understood in the Riley case, is that when you go after people's cell phone, and I realize I don't have mine on me, I'm, you know, getting a little jittery, it's over there somewhere. You know, when you go after, when you talk about either having surreptitious access to people's smartphones or perhaps impairing the security of people's smartphones, it is a very threatening idea and a very alarming idea. And that's the difference, I think, between the debate that we had in the first round in the 90s and the debate that we have now.
I think that's right. I think just to amplify on that point a little bit, the debate we had in the 90s, which I sort of covered as a young reporter and you were a real participant in, was a debate that was largely a matter of hypothetical. I mean, the participants in it didn't feel that way. But, you know, the concern was that the telecommunications companies were going digital and that they would encrypt mostly telephonic communications. And people were, the then FBI director, Louis Freeh, was very anxious about what he called digital telephony, which, you know, gave the possibility of going dark. And then there was this crazy little program that a few nerds used called PGP, which theoretically, if everybody bothered to use, could cause real problems for law enforcement. The thing is that, first of all, most people didn't use PGP. And by the way, we moved very quickly away from telephonic communications altogether, right? We moved sort of first to email and then to other platforms that were, while theoretically encryptable, in fact not encrypted. And so there was the problem didn't really materialize in quite the way people thought it would. Moreover, most people simply didn't use the products that were available to them to make. I mean, I've had a PGP encryption public key on my email tagline for the last several years. I've never gotten a PGP encrypted email. You know, it's so this is different because the default is different, and the default settings now are that things are encrypted, right, and that things are to one degree or another robustly protected. And so that makes everything more urgent. It makes it urgent from a law enforcement point of view because, contrary to what some of the privacy groups will tell you, there is a lot of communication that is dark to law enforcement. And the lower down the law enforcement chain you go, the more dark, the more communications are. Because if you're the police department in X and such small town, you have no capacity in this area. But it's also more dark, more urgent from an industry and a consumer point of view, because you're talking not merely about technological changes you might have to make as you develop or protections that you might someday choose to use but never have, but you're talking about changing the default settings on people's actual devices, interfering with security systems that they actually rely on. And I think that makes many, many more people feel like this is really about them than felt like it in the 90s. And it also means that there's a lot of cops around the country and a lot of FBI agents who are sitting on very frustrating cases. And that's before you get to the intelligence community. So I have a question for you.
All right.
I think the core difference between, among thoughtful people, among the screamers, there's a lot of other things. But among the people who really, you know, have a common language, the core difference between the people who are more sympathetic to Apple and the people who are more sympathetic to Comey and to the FBI is a question of how you see a world in which everybody's phone, both for communications purposes and for storage purposes, is essentially dark, a world of essentially perfect security. Do you see that world as A, a world that, you know, you rely on metadata. There's a lot more metadata out there than there used to be. You can get the metadata from people's thermostats and refrigerators. And so there's more data. It's just not content data. Or do you see it as a world in which there is a giant ungoverned space in the digital world in which a huge amount of communications is impenetrable, and that set of communications is not fundamentally replaceable by increases in communications metadata and non-communications metadata? And so my question is, why shouldn't we think about a world of global architecture that is really well encrypted on the communications content side as a very scary, ungoverned space, you know, sort of a virtual Yemen or Somalia? Why should we think of it as a tolerable, not scary thing?
So I think I have two starting points in thinking about that question. Starting point one is actually this conference and the growth of this conference and the growth of IAPP. Why has IAPP grown? Why does it take over the entire new Marriott, Marquis, whatever hotel this is in the convention center? Why does it take that over? Why are all of you here and you're just a small little slice of, what is it, 18,000 members, 21,000 members? I mean, some ungodly number of privacy officers. What is it, David? Sorry? 20,000 members. You know, when we were debating CALEA in the mid-90s or in the kind of early round of FTC privacy discussions in the late 90s, the idea that there would be 20,000 people who cared enough to fly from all over the world to Washington to talk about privacy was unthinkable. And why is that? Because there's an awful lot of data. There's an awful lot of data all over the place, and there are an awful lot of questions, not so much about how to make sure that it's accessible, but how to make sure that it's carefully managed and handled respectfully and all that. So my starting point, number one, is really a starting point that says the world has a lot more data in it, and it's available in many, many ways. Much far beyond just, you know, metadata as an alternative to content, but a world in which, to a certain extent, almost everything that happens with people, at least in the kind of more advanced industrialized world, is recorded, is visible, is detectable, and is analyzable. And so that, I think, creates some challenges for law enforcement and some opportunities for law enforcement. I'm really the last person to minimize in any way the challenges that I think law enforcement faces, because I think they're enormous. But I actually think their challenges have much more to deal with dealing with the vast amount of data that's actually out there and that isn't dark than in getting the what I think is still probably a relatively small subset of the data that I think absolutely is dark, and that absolutely there's no question that there are spaces in the world that are very hard for law enforcement to get at. That's one lens, is that we do really have a lot more data, and we all have to figure out how to address law enforcement access to that data. Some part of the reason why I think we're having such a moral panic about privacy and surveillance is because I think we haven't addressed the broader question of privacy expectations in the world overall. I think people don't, and surveys bear this out, people don't especially distinguish when they're assessing their privacy vulnerability between whether they're vulnerable to law enforcement or vulnerable to the commercial world. They feel more or less vulnerable in a very general sense. And I think that I think a lot of people at this conference have done a lot to try to help assure people that their personal information is handled carefully. But I actually think governments have done far too little to assure people that their data is handled respectfully. And part of the reason that we are turning to a sense that we have to protect personal data through purely technical means, which is some part of how we got to this whole odd dynamic between law enforcement and the Silicon Valley companies, is that the sense is that it's our only means of protection, that the technical means of protection are vital. That's kind of my privacy attitude. So I don't think it's that we're so much in Yemen or Somalia as I think we're in a state of really sort of global uncertainty about privacy questions. It makes it harder, I think, to answer the law enforcement questions clearly. The second point that I'd make is a point about security. I think there's a real incommensurability to this debate that's going on. True, you know, you have law enforcement people who I think very legitimately are saying, we have a real problem, we don't know what to do when we come upon a bricked phone. We don't know what to do when we're in you know, hot pursuit of a subject and the subject has dropped a device on the ground and we pick it up and it's nothing. It tells the time and that's it. That's a real problem, and I think we should all take that seriously as a problem. But it's true that the kind of marketing rhetoric has tended to create a simple opposition or a simple competition between law enforcement interest and Silicon Valley company and user interest. That is, you can hear Silicon Valley executives talk about the NSA or the FBI as their threat model. You can hear them saying, our goal, as I think you were saying earlier, is to build warrant-proof services. But I think that means something actually very different than it sounds. Especially if you think about it, as some of you may, from a security engineering perspective. From a security engineering perspective, a rationally minded, critically minded security engineer looks at the infrastructure that we've built and frankly sees a security disaster and feels so far behind the curve in actually providing reliable, secure, resilient, pervasive communications and information services, that anything that is posed as a requirement that deviates from building more secure services is regarded as a threat. And that in a very real sense, if you're a security engineer, because there are so many threats in the world, and because the threats are so capable, are so potent, as an engineer, one actually is not crazy to treat the threat model that you're designing against as the NSA or the FBI. And I think where there's an incommensurability here is that statement of engineering risk, of engineering threat model, which is the first thing any good security researcher does, any good security engineer does, that statement is taken as a moral statement or a legal statement as opposed to a technical statement.
And a marketing statement.
Well, and then yes.
Because Apple made some serious blunders in the way they talked about this, and I think it's worth bringing them out. First of all, when they released, I forget which version of it, iOS 8, I believe, they put up a privacy policy that, you know, contained words like, I'm paraphrasing here, we couldn't comply with warrants even if we wanted to, right? And they said some very, very in-your-face things. It was sort of in the immediate aftermath of Snowden, and they really, it was really sort of stuck in Comey's eye. And the second thing they did, which I think from, you know, goes a little bit beyond what you're describing, is they walked into the Eastern District of New York litigation, and this involves a phone that they actually do have the capacity to open, but they don't want to open it. And the reason they told the court that they don't want to open it is that it would be bad for their business marketing overseas, because they've postured themselves as, you know, sort of adversarial with respect to law enforcement, so it would undermine their self-presentation. So I think if you were sort of advising Apple 2 years ago about how to talk about what they were doing, you might take some lessons from everything they've done and say sort of don't do that. The one thing, and maybe this is the reason that they've done it, the one thing that they've really done successfully is mobilized an intense political constituency behind their point of view. And there's a lot of people who tweet about standing with Apple, you know, who, you know, make Apple, like, you know, it's one of the highest market capitalization companies in the world, sound like the oppressed of the earth, you know, like you're standing with Syrian refugees or something. So a few additional components. Sorry, go ahead.
Before you get there, I think we should explore that just a little bit. Suppose, just hypothetically, it were the case that if Apple complied with one of these orders, whichever one it is, or if Apple were seen in the world market as being somehow too close to U.S. law enforcement or national security interests, just suppose that were true, is that a legitimate... Who's supposed to address that part of this discussion? In other words, what I think we know is that in the aftermath of Snowden, there are questions raised about the relationship between U.S. tech companies and the law enforcement and national security side of the U.S. government. And there certainly has been an effort by other countries and other companies to exploit that. And there's at least a notional sense that people may be thinking, customers outside the U.S. may be thinking twice about what products and services to buy. Who's supposed to think about, who's supposed to weigh in the balance the question about the trustworthiness of U.S. Technology products and services?
Well, I mean, I think ideally the answer to that question would be Congress. That, you know, it is like so many things in our political culture, the idea that the national legislature has essentially nothing to say about this issue and is content to let us litigate it on the basis of, you know, principally a statute that's more than 200 years old. Not that I'm against geriatric statutes. You know, the Constitution's pretty old, too. But, you know, it's not the most up-to-date statute vis-a-vis current technology. The last time Congress had anything significant to say about this set of issues was CALEA, which is, you know, more than 20 years ago now. And the idea that we're going to have this discussion, which really weighs a lot of different competing interests without substantial input from the legislature, is not your fifth grade civics lesson, you know, of the way American government is supposed to work. I do think we have a tendency and, you know, to make this discussion a little bit too much of a putting liberty, privacy, and cybersecurity interests all on one side of the equation, and along with industry, and putting security and law enforcement and intelligence interests all on the other side of the equation. And there's this sort of balance, you know, that involves, and I think that's largely incorrect in the sense that, or it's, the scales are more complicated. They have more trays than that. So, first of all, there are privacy interests and security interests on both sides of this debate. One of, I think, Comey's most moving examples involves the Baton Rouge Police Department, which has the iPhone of a young woman who was murdered 8 months pregnant, and the police have no leads in the case, except her phone, on which her mother says she kept a fairly detailed diary of some sort. And they can't get into it because, for the same reason, they can't get into the San Bernardino iPhone. Now, interesting question whether they'll be able to break in now. But so it's an interesting question. What's her privacy interest in that? So I tweeted a little bit about this, and I got a very interesting response from a guy named Jacob Applebaum, who some of you may know of. He's a computer security guy in Berlin, very close to Snowden and the WikiLeaks people. And he tweeted back at me that I had it completely wrong. Her family has no interest in this, according to him. Rather, She had her privacy settings, and those are effectively a living will. And we should respect her privacy settings, irrespective of her family's interest in finding out what happened to her. So I think this is an answer that only an engineer could like. You know, that this is somebody who says, first of all, who probably reads the click-through agreements, right? Who probably knows what the default settings on his devices are. And I think the average woman in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, isn't doing that. And when Apple tells her, this is how you'll be most private and this is how you'll be most secure, and by the way, it's your default setting, so if you don't do anything, that's what it's going to be. I don't think she says to herself, what if I get murdered and this phone is the only investigative mechanism into solving the crime that I'm a victim of? And I think there's a lot of people who set their privacy settings without reference to the possibility that they may be victims of crimes. Similarly, I think there's actually, you know, when the FBI director represents security, and then a bunch of civil libertarians and industry are on the other side, we don't look at that and say, hey, there are real security objects on both sides of this discussion. But there are. And, you know, a lot of you represent the security of a lot of users. And most people aren't victims of crimes. Most people aren't perpetrators of crimes. But people are subject to all kinds of data breaches. And so what the optimal, I hate the word balance because it always sounds like a cop-out, but what the optimal admixture of security values and privacy values are in the discussion is, to me, a very non-obvious point. And I wish we could get away to a large degree from sort of Apple representing liberty and the FBI representing, you know, order and authority. I think the discussion's actually a lot more complicated than that.
So, Ben, what do you make of the fact that we've had, in the last month, roughly speaking, statements from a number of national security officials, both in the U.S. and in the U.K., who've come out pretty squarely and said, we're against mandatory backdoors, infrastructure-wide guarantees for law enforcement access or national security access are the wrong security choice. This is everyone from Secretary of Defense here, Ash Carter, the director of GCHQ, the UK surveillance agency, who actually did a 180-degree turnaround on his government's position because Prime Minister Cameron earlier in the year has said there should be no unbreakable encryption, and now his leading surveillance authority, who I believe did check with his boss, the Prime Minister, said actually it's a bad idea. So how do you? And I don't mean to say that means they're right and the FBI is wrong. But how do you think about the fact that we've had a pretty strong statement of views that aligns with the view that says infrastructure security should trump. Oh, I can't say that. Infrastructure security should be given greater weight than individual law enforcement access guarantees.
So first of all, Danny, you're understating your case because domestically, both Mike Hayden and Mike Chertoff, who are hardly cringing civil libertarians, have said something similar. Before answering your question, the one pushback I would give on it is it's not clear what the FBI is asking for, right? And this is the part that is really, really misunderstood in the public domain. The government has not advanced a legislative position. They have not said what they think the rules should be. Now, No one in government will say why this is out loud. I'm not in government. I will say why this is out loud, which is that the different agencies completely disagree about this subject. The intelligence community doesn't fundamentally care very much, or at least a lot of it doesn't fundamentally care, because they have other ways and they're allowed to do legally all sorts of things that the FBI is not really allowed to do. So this isn't the biggest problem in the world for the NSA, contrary to common belief. It's a huge problem for domestic law enforcement, both at the federal and local, particularly at the local level. On the other side of the equation is the State Department and the Commerce Department, both of whom in different ways represent, the State Department represents, has a profound set of ideological and I think quite laudable positions in favor of the use of these technologies by people in authoritarian countries, and they've encouraged that. And the Commerce Department, of course, represents U.S. industry. So, anybody who talks about the unitary executive has never dealt with this problem. There simply is no, cohesive executive branch position. And then there's industry, right? So, one way to think about Apple in this is that, and I've joked about this in some of my posts on Lawfare, is that Apple has a seat in the interagency process. When Tim Cook has something to say to the president, he picks up the phone and he calls the president. And that's a lot of access that that senior government officials don't necessarily have in just a sort of day-to-day sense. I think all of this is a long way of saying that it's not at all clear what the government's actual position is because it's in flux. Comey has a position, and his position is that we need to do something, but he hasn't said what. And the Justice Department, in a particular litigation or pair of litigations, has a position that the All Writs Act, with respect to previously engineered technology, can be used to compel technology companies to provide assistance in breaking those technologies.
So just for clarity, because you've covered the Justice Department for a long time, should we interpret the Justice Department's filings, whether in the Brooklyn Court or in San Bernardino, as an administration position on what the law ought to be?
No, we should interpret it as an administration position about what existing law is and what existing law entitles the FBI to get in the way of assistance from a company. And the administration and the government will always or generally try to litigate for the most favorable positions it can, interpretations of federal law that it can get, like any litigant.
Do you think the White House could have, should have, would have, under any other circumstances, changed the Justice Department position in those two cases? Let me say why I'm asking this question, because I do think people look at the kind of conduct of the administration on this issue, and as Ben says, there's obviously not a clear, President Obama hasn't gotten up and given a big speech about this, saying exactly what he thinks. There isn't legislation. He hasn't, by the same time, threatened to veto anything yet. We do have lawyers representing the United States government, presumably under the control of the president, who go into court and say Apple should be required to do X, Y, and Z things. So it does leave a lot of people legitimately scratching their heads, saying, What is the administration's position? Is this a reflection of the fact that the White House defers to the Justice Department's prosecutorial discretion, or what is this?
I think it's all of the above. First of all, it's extraordinarily unusual for the White House to tell the Justice Department how to conduct a criminal investigation, and that would be, is generally scandalous when it happens, and in a complex counterterrorism investigation, it would be somewhere near unthinkable, I think. So that's the background thing. And generally speaking, the White House doesn't even know what the Justice Department is doing in a counterterrorism case like this. And asking is a little bit taboo. But the second thing is that if you're the White House and you have this interagency zoo on this issue, and you have very, very heavy pressure from the tech industry and agencies that are in diametrically opposite places, you have a few... one really good way to proceed is to let the Justice Department litigate things, see where they go, and see how the courts change the default environment of the law. I do think there is a strategic component of the sort of wait and see how things play out from the White House's point of view. Now, honestly, that's going to be a little bit more complicated once you start getting competing legislative proposals, which is likely to happen in the very near future.
Luckily, we seem to have a small number of legislative days left before the election. I want to suggest for us one final question, and then we'd be happy to take questions from the audience. Do you think that technology companies ought to consider should technology companies consider law enforcement access in the way they design their services?
I'm actually really interested in your answer to that question. So my answer to that question is they inevitably do. They think about it either in the prospective decision to make their products as impenetrable as possible, including to law enforcement, or they make a decision, the companies that we haven't discussed in this conversation are Google and Facebook, right? Companies that have reasons of their own to leave certain data unencrypted, like that they mine it for advertising purposes and for content analysis purposes. And one consequence of that collaterally is that they're able to provide certain things to law enforcement that companies that engineer in other directions shouldn't do or can't do. I think that there's it is inevitable that when engineers get together and decide what they're trying to build, and with lawyers looking over their shoulder, that somebody raises the question, what happens when we get a subpoena or a warrant? And those will inflect certain engineering decisions. To me, the question is really, do you design it with an awareness of law enforcement to preclude access? Do you design it with an awareness of law enforcement to facilitate access under certain circumstances? Or do you, do something? But you're not going to do anything without an awareness of the impact on possible litigation and investigations.
So I guess I think that, to begin with, the distance between lawyers in any given technology company and engineers is probably a little greater than you suggest. I'm not saying there's no interaction, but I think they're on relatively separate floors of the building, if you will. There's no question there's a point at which any reasonably large-sized company does some kind of product review. Many of you probably do it for privacy purposes. Maybe you do it for security purposes as well. But my guess is if we took a survey of people in this room or people in this conference overall, could privacy officers, could lawyers instruct engineers how to build security services? Probably not so much. Does it get considered? I would say, based on my experience, much more after the fact than in advance. There's no question, as products get rolled out, as services get rolled out, you have to think about this, and then you do get orders, and you have to figure out what to do about them. But I think that the process of security architecture is so fraught and complex, and frankly, so competitive inside the company in itself, that the opportunity for law enforcement access design requirements to come in is, I think, pretty thin. What I would say about what companies ought to do is, I think the only answer really can be is they ought to do what's required by law. I don't think it's feasible, and it may not even be responsible, but it's certainly not feasible for a company on its own, unilaterally, to say, well, we're designing the service, let's think about how to make sure there's a law enforcement access mechanism. Because the generally accepted view is that those mechanisms reduce the security of the product. And I think that's a point that we've kind of arrived at in this debate, that if you add in the opportunity for third-party access of any sort, whoever the third party is, you are increasing your security risk. By how much is something that varies a lot and is not always easy to quantify, but it is going to be to the disadvantage of a company in a competitive environment to say, here we have this product and law enforcement can get it too. No additional customer is going to come and say, I'll buy that product. No one is going to come and buy that, whereas many, I would guess, will buy another one. So what that means is that it is not to say it shouldn't be done. What it means is that we have to figure out how to take decisions as a democratic society about what those obligations are going to be, and everyone has to figure, all companies will have to figure out how to follow them. And I think that's partly what, back to our kind of our first question about the reaction to Comey's speech, I think that's part of the reason for the very kind of alarmed reaction, is that especially, I think he actually was trying to be respectful and solicit help in saying, we need this, but I don't know how to do it. But when an engineer hears that a customer, some outside person needs something, but they don't really say what they mean by what they need, it is somewhere between an irritant and just noise that's hard to parse out, which I say with all due respect to the FBI director, who I think in many ways has been a real hero on civil liberties in the past. But I think his statement and the current posture of law enforcement is really seriously miscalculated to have a kind of a coherent conversation with technology companies. What I think we know about the internet environment overall is that when we inject, legitimate or illegitimate, but when we inject any policy considerations into design, if they're not, when they're clearly specified, they're ultimately accepted. There was a big fuss, you remember, about like DMCA takedown notice. Everyone thought this was a big disaster. It ended up it wasn't. It ended up it was just fine and actually probably quite good. But until it became clear what you actually had to do to comply with that law, all the designers were very jittery about it. And so I think the question that, you know, both of us sort of were working on here is, there's going to have to be a clearly stated set of requirements and, frankly, set of mandates if there's going to be any sort of change, if we expect any kind of change in design.
So let's go to questions as people.
Dave, will you be the Phil Donahue?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
There's some over there.
And everyone in that section, we told you, you're not even going to get to ask questions. No.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes.
My name is David Chapin. My question to you is, as far as I know, this might be the first instance where there's, through a court order, a creative company was forced to create something from scratch that didn't exist prior to that moment in time. So in other words, this company Apple was forced, would have been forced to create a piece of code that never existed before, that they never really even contemplated to make, and they would be forced to be creative. I wonder what your thoughts on that are, whether that is a precedent or not, and your comments on that.
So I have a few thoughts. So one is that the premise is at least a little bit more complicated than that. So the Justice Department contends in its briefs, and I've actually not gone back and looked at the cases that it cites, that there are prior examples under the All Writs Act in which companies had to write code in order to comply with Now, this is a little bit different from that because this is developing a new piece of software rather than you get an order to do something and you have to write code to do it. But moreover, at least if you go outside the area of court orders and into the area of compliance with congressional statute, the proposition then is actually totally common and normal. So banks, for example, are obliged under a provision of the USA Patriot Act to engage in what's called suspicious activity reporting, which is, you know, any combinations of wire transfers that look suspicious under a number of different regs, they have an obligation to report to the Treasury Department. Now, how, of course, do you go through all your transactions and come up with whichever are going to be suspicious? You write code to do it. And the banks have all developed these very elaborate suspicious activity reporting algorithms purely for purposes of compliance with this federal statute. There are a lot of examples of things like that. And by the way, one of them is called PRISM, you know, which, you know, involves the internet companies, which is, you know, an NSA implementation of 702. All of the FISA Amendments Act, all of the companies have had to develop systems to comply with 702 orders and interface with that. So there's nothing especially unusual about requiring companies to write code. There may be something unusual about doing it under the All Writs Act, or there it may be a little bit less unusual than Apple thinks, but it certainly would have been, had it happened, a significant advance in that under the All Writs Act.
I really agree with Ben. First of all, I'd say I think writing software is an extraordinarily creative act. I teach an institution that's all about teaching how to do that well. I think it's every bit as artistic and expressive and everything else as being a sculptor, but it's also not all that different from being an engineer who has to build, you know, scrubbers that you put on top of coal-fired power plants, or frankly, the software that allows video companies to provide closed captioning. I mean, we're in a digital world. By definition, many of the more and more regulatory requirements will entail writing code of some sort or another. I think that there are a lot of very substantial burdens placed on Apple as a result of the order that the government sought. But I think that the First Amendment concerns are really not where we ought to be focusing. And again, I think there are just many examples of where compliance with law requires writing software, and there'll be more and more of them.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Stefan Dalal. The president, a few weeks ago at South by Southwest, made some comments which I thought were interesting, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, you know, regardless of which side of the debate you sit on, you can't take an absolutist view. And so my question is, I think privacy and security often is conflated, and so my question is, can exceptional security coexist with privacy?
I'm not entirely sure I understand what the question means. So I will say that we often put off against one another, juxtapose privacy interests and security interests. I think this is a very mischievous intellectual trick that we play on ourselves. As a very few things that make you, as a general matter, your privacy and your security are integrally related to one another. Things that undermine your privacy tend to do so by undermining your security, or vice versa. And if you, what is the case is that a certain aggregate collective security can be quite inconsistent with a certain individual's privacy and security. But there you're not holding up against one another privacy and security interests. You're holding up whose privacy and security interests you care about vis-a-vis who else's. And so I think there's a real mischief in the way we talk about the relationship between privacy and security that, you know, bears more examination than it often gets.
It seems like a lot of the public debate has been focused on collection of the data and whether that should be permissible under the various constructs you've been talking about. It doesn't seem to me there's been a great deal of focus on the utility of restrictions on use. And, you know, in a room like this full of privacy professionals, many of whom are running complex and robust compliance organizations, I think many people here would have an appreciation for the important role of training people on what they can't do, processes that are in place to encourage appropriate use and discourage, detect, and prevent and correct inappropriate use. And it seems to me that in this Apple versus FBI discussion, some of what has gotten lost is any discussion about the extent to which use controls can be really effective means of mitigating concerns that might otherwise exist around collection of data. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
I think it's a great observation, and I think many of our more subtle and useful and flexible privacy laws, as you know, are actually based on controlling certain uses, controlling harmful uses of data, preventing harmful uses of data, but not trying to make binary decisions about what should be collected or not, because we all understand information has utility. It just may also be harmful in some context. I think that the part of the reason that but rules that govern use require that the public trust the institutions that are enforcing those rules. And, you know, I will say I've been particularly disappointed in the last 8 years that we haven't even been able to pass updates to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, basic things that would help increase public trust in the environment overall. I was disappointed we didn't pass the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights. I think that, as I said earlier, I think part of the reason we're in this, a lot of the sort of sharp-edged choices that I think Ben very correctly frames as false choices, we're in because people don't feel a sense of confidence that we can be nimble here, that we have institutions that can manage the complexity of these environments. And I think that it's really a lesson, frankly, for law enforcement and national security agencies around the world that if they want to be trusted with these tools that do have real risk associated with them, they're going to have to show that they can function with a real sense of transparency and accountability. I give the NSA a lot of credit for taking steps in that direction. I think you see similar kind of things happening in the UK. You see, hopefully, the rest of Europe will catch up as well. But I think that if law enforcement wants to be trusted, it can't always be in the mode of pushing the law to the maximum possible extent, because that doesn't make people feel good.
Just one additional point on this. You know, there is a really peculiar dichotomy in the federal government in the use restriction department between the intelligence community and the law enforcement community. So one of the things we learned about the Snowden documents, and, you know, it was knowable before the Snowden documents, but the Snowden documents really highlighted it, is the neurotic, detailed compliance regime that your average NSA analyst lives under every day. And, you know, who has access to what material, what clicks, what they have to go through in order to get access to particular material, what the reporting mechanisms are for the most trivial violations of those rules. All of this is, you know, at a level of finely honed neurosis in NSA. And I mean that in a good way. By contrast, in the criminal system, you know, you get material under a warrant or a grand jury subpoena or And it goes in a big box somewhere. And there's a, you know, Rule 6E of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure say you can't leak it. And beyond that, there's no use restrictions. And you can kind of do whatever you want. I think the discrepancy between what the criminal system tolerates in the use of material and what the intelligence community tolerates on the back end use areas is remarkably vast, the disparity, and very hard to justify, frankly, given the sensitivity of a lot of information that law enforcement collects.
I think that's it, and I'd like to thank Danny and Ben, and thank you all for coming.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the International Association of Privacy Professionals for permission to use this audio. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.